dead is the head of the
Thank my hosts, Apex Art, who's Hospitality I've been receiving for the last 3 weeks with 1 week to go. I should say that the APEX program is geared towards giving experiences to people who have never had experience of New York before. So it's a real privilege to be here in that sense. Everybody thinks that the rest of the world flocks to New York, forgetting that the rest of the world has all its own geographical circuits and centres. So when you're a professional in one of those places, you invest a lot of time and money and effort in travelling in a circuit or a satellite zone around that place where your professional base is constituted. And for me, at one time living in New Zealand and Australia, you spend a great deal of time circulating in Southeast Asia and on the west coast of this continent, because that's your point of reference. Now that I live in a territory which, for convenience sake, we will call Eastern Europe, I mean, we spend a lot of time traveling within that continental circuit. And New York somehow remains outside, even though it's the centre of the publishing world and writing about art in many ways. The experience of art here doesn't necessarily touch those places. And for that reason, I'm grateful. The title of the conversation this evening, which I formulated, is Three Moons of Jupiter, a conversation from the post-communist universe. I came up with that title for various reasons. I've mentioned satellites, and of course Jupiter has 13 moons. And I'm thinking about Vilnius in Lithuania, where I live, Leipzig from the former east of Germany, and Praha, the capital of the Czech Republic, which was communist Czechoslovakia, as three of those moons. And for argument's sake, we'll call them the three first discovered by Galileo, which are Io, Europa, and Ganymede. You can guess which is which, but it's nice that one of those moons was called Europa, which is what we're talking about. Also, Jupiter, as you know, the largest planet in our solar system. And there's a sense in which when we think about the world through the nexus of the Cold War, which we understand ended at the end of the Reagan administration and the birth of the Clinton administration. East, this huge bloc known as the East, dominated the political imagination of Americans and America. And there was some sort of face-off. And there's a sense in which Jupiter is still there, and the red eye of Jupiter is, of course, symbolic for that red eye of communism, which watched over the three countries that we came from for so long, and still watches over the popular imagination of various people in administrations in this country, and particularly with the rise and rise of the extreme right-wing Putin government in Russia and the government in Belarus. That said, it seems to be a disproportionate concentration. Because when you think about the world, one-third of the entire world's population lives within a four-hour flight of Beijing. So if there is any master planet in our new geopolitical universe, its situation is somewhere dominated by Beijing, Shanghai, Jakarta, and New Delhi or Bombay. And I think in the American universe, it's worth thinking about that. So without further ado, I would like the two artists sitting to my left and right just to introduce themselves, because I think in a talk it's always worth knowing more about the people so you can have a personal engagement later on in the conversation. And I'd ask Diana to say something first.
Yeah, hello, so I'm Diana. I'm from, so I live in Leipzig and Berlin, so both cities and Berlin. And I came to New York 1 week ago, so everything is quite new to me. And I apologize for my English, which is not that good yet, as it should be. So maybe sometimes I will use some words, also, or use some bad words, but I try my best. So my work, so I work mostly with photography, but also in the last months, I started to do intervention in public space and installations. And the main focus of my work is the urban space. And I'm especially interested in its perception and in general ideas about urbanity and what is the big city or the metropolis. And what especially attracts me is the ambivalence between fascination of the metropolis and intrigue of the metropolis. So I consider the big city not only as an architectural or social structure, if not also as a kind of display or projection screen of different kind of hopes, dreams, fears of its observers and inhabitants. And so this is what I try to investigate in my work.
Ask Jan to say something from his Czech perspective.
Jan, to say in Prague from Czech Republic, and I think everybody reacts more for Czechoslovakia, or it's like still more common, you know, in memory of people, let's say. It's also my first time in New York, and I've been here a week and something. To apologize for my English, which is probably sometimes really lousy. Well, the topics or what's my theme? Like, I'm concerning to some kind of formal abstract language, which is derived from geometrical tendencies.
So Jan's work is on
the screen. Yeah, this is kind of my works, tendencies in like painting and typography, and I use the constructivistic or semi-constructivistic language. I'm trying to shift it, the original content, into like the contemporary circumstances. I work with wide range of media, installations, video, and computer-based graphics, and also even with paintings sometimes.
Yeah. As the title of the talk also sort of intimated, I mean, there's something about science fiction in that title, because science fiction was something shared across Eastern Europe. The most famous of all authors, who of course you all know, translated into English, was the Polish author Stanisław Lem, whose most famous work is Stellaris, most famous because it became the great film from the 70s, directed by Andrei Tarkovsky. Just for a matter of interest, Tarkovsky's lead actor in two of his films is actually a Lithuanian. His name is Banyomis. But there are various other things that connect the three countries in different ways. Leipzig and Lithuania were the leading centres in the moves in the late 80s to disestablish communism. And interestingly, the titles of the three, the Czechs were just beaten to it by the Hungarians somehow, but the titles of their three revolutions were the Peaceful Revolution in Leipzig, the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia, and the Singing Revolution in Lithuania. And there's a sense within the titles of those things that you could see they evolved out of a very civil sense of protest, and also that the time had come for those barriers to come down. That said, and in the photo, for those of you that got the email announcement, I chose that photo, which was the reoccupation of Vilnius in January of 1991 by Soviet troops when Gorbachev realized the empire was about to crumble. The objects, anti-tank defenses, are actually called Czech hedgehogs. That's the title for the anti-tank defense. It proved particularly useless in the Russian front when the Germans were rolling north to Moscow. But another interesting thing about the Czech hedgehog is that they're actually based on a constructivist sculpture by the Latvian constructivist and theorist Carl Jorgensen, who developed this whole theory of tansegrity and intersecting triangles. So it's a little instance of art becoming real politics, which is worth knowing. I should also note that looking around the room, I see people here from Estonia, from Russia, from Lithuania, doubtless friends of the two artists here. So I hope in conversation time, many of you can bring personal perspectives to what we're all saying, especially as I've only lived in this place for 4 years, so I don't necessarily have the same personal experience of what we're talking about. Interestingly, Lithuania and Czech historically are both countries which have shared mutable geographies and mutable monarchies. In the case of Lithuania, Jagiellonian Tsarist, in the case of Czechia, Bohemian, Habsburgian, and the Hohenzollerns, and territories changing, and then of course the sad Anschluss of 1939. Leipzig, interestingly, in this idea of science fiction, is the place where Heisenberg did his work, who's the physicist that we best know for the Heisenberg principle. The Heisenberg principle proposes that when you look at something or when you put something under examination or experimentation, you change its nature by dint of that observation. And that is actually a concept that is crucial to Lem's Solaris, because the planet, which is under observation, changes to reflect the hopes and dreams of the people that are studying it. And I think there's an internal criticism of the communistic system within science fiction, because it's looking towards the future, hoping that a utopia will happen, implying that it hasn't happened in the here and now, even during this era of relative freedom in the 50s and the techno-modernization of Khrushchev and the leaders in those other countries. Enough talking by me, but I'm actually curious to know, Diana, whether you think that there is a shared Eastern European experience and whether it remains important in the new world, now that we all actually belong to the European Union and being surely integrated into the West.
For my person, I wouldn't consider myself as especially Eastern European, so I don't feel like an Eastern European. But I was a teenager when the war came down, so I experienced a little bit the GDR system, but so I wasn't quite there. But I think it still had some legacies, which in a way are productive for me, and in the other way sometimes not. So it's like a contradiction. And I think the two strongest legacies which I observe in my character or my approach is the first thing is like a strong skepticism towards everything, because I experienced this there were always like two opinions, the official opinion and then the private opinion. And when I was like young, for me it was like the reality that there were two realities, and I always had to switch between these both realities. And then dual system came down, so then this is a really strong break in my biography that I experienced that something what was said that could last forever or was really strong, and that from one day to another could run down and a total change of everything. So I'm always aware of that nothing is fixed and nothing is sure, and always can be in a process and always can change towards something totally unpredictable. And the second thing is that when I was a child, I was totally integrated into the system. I had to take part of different movements, and so now I recognize that I have developed a great antipathy against any movement which has like strong rules or fixed or strict forms. And this is most important for me now, that everything is open and that I'm free to do what I want. So that because I was already so part of so many movements of pioneers and the Free German Youth was called FDR, that now I don't have this desire to be part of a movement, which maybe people which come from West Germany, it's like a different thing. So there's this song, I think it is from Topotronic, I'm not sure, I want to be part of a youth movement, so I don't know what it means. It's not like that, so. And maybe these two experiences, I think that quite a lot of people, at least people from which have my age and come from East Germany, share these experiences. So sometimes it's productive, but sometimes it stops me as well. So it's like
a dialectic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
In my case, yeah, I think I can agree with Diana, because I mean, former Czechoslovakia before 89, everything was more or less still. Like, yeah, everything was nothing, like, could move, like, that. And our in common, our shared experience, at least for me, was kind of a hated experience, because the only countries we could visit that we could go to were the former satellites of like Russia or from the Soviet Union, and even there were some exceptions, because for example former Yugoslavia was a bit Western for Czechoslovakia. It was a bit dangerous, so I think everybody was somehow looking at the Western world without any critical reason or critical sense. I think now it has changed, basically. I don't wish now that we share any common experience. I think we all the former satellites look or stare somehow to bigger centers, which are basically still the Western world. I mean, in cultural sense, maybe I don't know, in case of amount of people, or completely different, but the cultural experience is still coming from the Western world, mostly.
I mean, if I was to identify capitals within the region, it's interesting because we do have our own capitals,
mm-hmm.
And culturally, I would propose that they would be Moscow, Ljubljana, and to some degree Leipzig, which is interesting. And the great deal of attention is actually paid particularly towards Moscow and Ljubljana in the last 4 or 5 years, looking for leadership. It's interesting to know about the Prague Spring, which we all know, and in the West it tends to be famous because it's the point in which communist intellectuals throughout Europe finally threw their hands in the air and disavowed the Central Communist Party, because the French intellectuals had been very happy. Picasso, one of the most famous amongst them, had been happy to turn a blind eye towards the behaviour of Stalin. But the Prague Spring, when the 7,000 tanks rolled in to put down the soft reforms that Dubček was taking on, was a moment when everybody paid attention. It's worth noting historically that those 7,000 tanks were actually comprised of Warsaw Pact troops. So it wasn't just the Russians rolled in. There was something called the Warsaw Pact, which connected the USSR and all at that time its satellites. So there were actually soldiers there from Yugoslavia, from Poland, from... So it was the pinnacle of a common experience, sadly a very negative one. At that moment, the Albanians and the Romanians refused. So that's a high point of their consciousness. One thing I've observed since being in the United States on this trip, I haven't been here since I was in the West Coast in 2004, is it's the most invasive policing of any other place other than Russia, which is very ironic. You have more searches and more police personnel carrying heavy weapons here than anywhere else in the world, apart from when you visit Moscow or Petersburg. I think that's something rather ironic, considering this is supposed to be the beacon of democracy and freedom. So I just wanted to ask casually what your experiences were of arriving at US immigration and customs on this trip, and whether you need visas to be here, and what process you have to go through.
I just know that our president, like Czech president, said yesterday or today even, that he's ready to sign the pact about the American radar, which is kind of strong political theme in Czech Republic recent 2 months, maybe longer even, which is quite, well, I think this sign of this pact is quite important for cancelling the visa duty to US. It's quite, so I still had to ask for a visa, and yeah, my experience is quite, like, let's say normal, because I'm used to different manners. So it was quite formal and correct, let's say. It took quite a long time, I must say. It took maybe 2 or 3 weeks to get them, and some, like, many papers, and so, like, a lot of administration, at least, it was that.
And do people in the audience know about this proposed satellite system in Czech Republic and missiles in Poland? Because it's very funny here, you get almost no world news, even world news about your government. At the moment, there's a new containment policy being put forward by the United States in their NATO role, where they have now signed the agreement with Václav Havel, it sounds, to put a new satellite tracking system in the Czech Republic and they want to put a new anti intercontinental ballistic missile system with maybe some nuclear warheads on the northern border of Poland. There's also a plan to, even though the Ukraine is not this time an EU member, they want to make Ukraine a member of NATO so that they can expand to the northern border of the NATO alliance. And of course, if Václav Havel, in signing this, gets visa-free entry for his citizens from the Czech Republic. And Diana, what was your experience of arriving in the country?
So I need as well a visa because I stay longer than 2 months. And I applied, I had to apply in Germany, and it was, I found it quite expensive. So because I'm in Europe, as till now, I only travel in Europe, and this is quite easy for me because I never need nothing. So I had to pay, and then I had to make 3 lines, so it took me 2 hours to get it. And I was quite irritated because I had to give my fingerprints and everything, so I felt supervised a little bit like in the GDR. So, and when I came in, everything was okay, but what I didn't recognize is I was thinking, now I have a visa and I can come whenever I want during the next 10 years and stay how long I want. So I booked my flight already, my flight back, and then in the airport, the man in the office told me that, so I missed 2 days, so I can stay with my visa only 6 months. I didn't recognize that, so now I missed 2 days, and so I know I have to change my flight. And this was quite irritating for me, so because I'm not used to apply for visa.
So I met with both artists yesterday to talk about today and also look a little bit more at their work. So Jan, in the sort of both the rectilinear logics of your work and in the plays you have with codes and language, I mean it was quite apparent that you're interested in cryptology and maybe futurology or different points of science fiction which feed it into what I had to say earlier. Could you say something about that and what sci-fi meant to you when you were young?
Yeah. Well, as a kid I began with the comic books, kind of mixture of our like original Czech, let's say communist there, like free of politics, let's say, I think, comic books and the stolen, or somehow, yes, yeah, stolen comic books from like US and wherever. And then I started to be obsessed with some kind of, simple sci-fi, Czech sci-fi, and then the sci-fi mentioned already, like Stanislav Lem and Bratislav Stugatsky, made some novel. Just called.
Can you just speak up just a little bit?
Yeah, sorry. Road Trip?
Picnic?
Yeah. I think, if I remember well, it was published in sometime in during the 80s in Czech, and the print run was 350,000 pieces, which is unbelievable amount for such a small country as we are. At the time we were maybe 14 or 15 million people, and now the bestseller achieved print runs like 5 or 10,000 maximum. So almost everybody has to read this book before he saw it eventually in Tarkovsky's movie. So I think a lot of my work, despite that it doesn't seem so, is based on my experience as a kid, or like youngster, let's say. But it takes some kind of geometrical form on this dreams and hesitations of the time.
No, Diana, your work, as people are now seeing, is fascinated by buildings and fascinated by, shall we say, the in-between zones or somehow the hyphenated zones of the city where things get a little bit out of control. I know you actually grew up in Thuringia in a village. I mean, could you say something about your early fascination with maybe the larger buildings and like the radio towers of you know, East Germany? Because the GDR was really involved in one of the great building competitions. You know, in the Cold War, there were very many East-West building contests. The most fascinating one between Korea and Romania. I don't know if you know about this, but the Romanians and the North Koreans had a completely obsessive, competitive building race in the 60s.
Yeah, so I think my work is strongly influenced that I grew up in a village. And Thuringia was in the south of the GDR, so I lived quite close to the border already, and it was like the dead end of the GDR. So if the GDR was already considered as the most boring country in the world, so the part where I am growing up was the most boring part of the GDR. And so there were no big cities in reach for me. And so for me, when I was like a teenager, then the big city was the ideal projection screen for to imagine myself in more intensive life or everything. Yeah, so what you amplify with big cities like neon lights and traffic, encounters, adventures. So this was where my fascination for the big city came from. And I remember when every year I went with my parents to have holiday on the seaside, and then we crossed with the train like this area of Leipzig and Berlin, and when I saw from the train I saw this housing projects, and this was for me really the feeling of big city. So this is why I'm attracted to, it has to be dense, like density, and it has to be like with high houses. So this is why I'm really attracted to things still to this housing projects. And in general, I'm more interested in the neighborhoods of, or in the areas of daily life than in like city centers, because the city centers are more and more like similar and too artificial. So this is why I always, doesn't matter in which city I am, I always look or find the same places.
Now, I know you studied literature before you went to art school, particularly looking at Franz Hesse and the Sagenberg and ideas about the flaneur, and etc. But you don't seem to find opportunity to make the work you now make related to that in Leipzig or Berlin, where you live. Even though Berlin has many still sort of bombed out zones or in-between zones or no man's lands. Could you tell me why that might be? Well,
I think, yeah, this is the, so I wrote my thesis about the perception of the flaneur, the perception of the big city, which the figure of the flaneur has. And I think what the flaneur always tries to find or to be is like, he wants to be, he wants to explore the city space and then to be like a kind of seismograph. So he wants to detect his surrounding, and to be this kind of seismograph means that you have to make yourself a little bit to an object or to leave your daily life perspective. And for this it's really important that you get out of your daily surroundings. So this is why for me it's really difficult to work to make photographs in the city where I'm living in, because I know every street already, and this experience of the first view, the first look, which is really important for the flaneur, I can't have this anymore in Leipzig or in Berlin, and I need maybe a little bit this kind of exotic attraction which cities abroad have to me, because then I can find things which surprising for me and because I don't know them, and maybe this is why I can't.
And your family in Paris, which is the center of the Derive.
Yeah, I started in Paris to do photographs, and then when I was in Paris, it was in 1998. Mm-hmm. I spent 1 year in Paris, and I started, took my photographs, and I was strongly influenced by Situationist writings on the city, and so I discovered this concept of the reef and psychogeography, and this is what plays an important role in my work.
Jan, on the other hand, when we were talking yesterday, you actually identified Prague as a very productive place for an artist to live and work, yet so often we're frustrated because the infrastructures in cities like yours and mine and Vilnius are actually, they yet to be established. Could you say something?
Yeah, I think on one hand it's quite productive for the artists because they have to care for themselves, like, basically. Everybody has to work. Almost everybody has to work in like civil profession, just a small percentage of artists can live from their income from the art. But there is quite a strong community of artists around the galleries, for example, and they are not really involved by institutions, which is good and bad at the same time. The bad side of this is that there is no like real attention of media, for example. For example, the biggest daily paper in Czech Republic cancelled the section of art, like visual art, which is like self-explanatory.
So you think there's more productive space in the environment because there's not a market?
Yeah,
and you don't have to deliver yourself to it.
I think there are just two really commercial galleries in capital, in Prague, which they are by accident, I don't know, run by foreigners. And they have like maybe 50 or less, or 30 people together from Czech who are represented by them, and the rest is like free somehow. Yeah, but yeah, the wrong side on the other hand is that the output is not professional enough in terms of production, etc., because there are no money for that. So,
yesterday when we were talking, Diana, you identified a number of productive potentials of capitalism, shall we say. And we could say that the classical emergence of the Flaneur, the Baudelairean, and the Benjaminesque Flaneur, of course, is related to the birth of the of Haussmann's well-lit and well-shot city. Can you say something about that in your relationship?
The potential of...
The productive potential of capitalism in that sort of... If Jan is identifying that, you know, one is productive.
Yeah, I think what attracts me in general on capitalism is this promise of possibility, so that this is exactly what also for me the big city stands for, and especially New York is like the capital of the dream of possibility. And in the same way, I challenge this fascination which I have, and this is a constant contradiction in my work. And I feel especially, to give an example, I feel especially attracted by every kind of public advertisement in the street. So maybe because I don't consider it in the first view as advertisement, if not as images of the city, which speak about desires. And this is where, for me, the potential lies in, so that I can meet the signs and symbols which maybe could be representations of capitalism. I could read them in the other way, so that I could find a potential in reading it in a different way. So to obviously misunderstand it. So, and I think it's like a dialectic way of thinking, so that the potential of capitalism lies in its negation. So it's a little bit difficult to explain it in English, but so in Germany, for instance, there is a strong movement in the moment of people which don't want any more public advertisement and which don't want any more neon lights and neon signs. And I don't agree with these people, because I like the more advertisement industry, the better, because I think in this inflation lies like a potential, like it could be lead to a total absurdity and senselessness, which opens up new possibilities of perception. So this is what I think is the kind of potential.
Which got me thinking about black markets, for one, which played a very important role and still play an important role within the broader Eastern Europe, both in Lithuania and Russia and places like Romania, Albania in particular. But in conversation yesterday, Jan, we were talking about your early fascination with Black Sabbath and with KISS. And I mean, those of you who know the KISS logo, I mean, the KISS logo is the absolute definitive teenage self-actualization, because they first wrote about it on the cover. But I mean, they came up with their logo on the cover of one of their school notebooks and kept it for the rest of their days.
The ACDC was like very similar.
But could you say something about your fascination with Black Sabbath, KISS, and the black market generally?
Yeah, I think I wasn't actually fascinated by the groups or music of them. I was just fascinated by their logos, because sooner than I knew the music, I knew their logos and their aura and the rumors around them. Anyway, the black market in Czech Republic was quite strongly developed since I was a kid or teenager, in terms of goods and music and ideas as well, because, for example, music or groups and everything took some kind of different ideas to this communistic atmosphere that it's like shared information. It was somehow connecting people and socializing them around these like centers, and dividing them as well, because it was something like shared secrets. I remember also the like copying of the cassettes that were involved with analog.
Real to real.
Yeah, real to real. It was really kind of very strange. And now it's, for me, now it's kind of really attractive aesthetics, I would say.
And Diana, despite talking about the positive potential of advertising, mm-hmm. I mean, I know you're fascinated with graffiti,
mm-hmm.
a graffiti which is a sort of black market symbology or sign, because it appears where it shouldn't, and it's traded amongst the people that do it. So taggers actually, you know,
mm-hmm.
trade off on one another. Could you say something about that? And tell me if even as a younger teenager you have black market memories?
No. There were no black market memories.
Yeah.
No, but yes, too, I'm quite fascinated by graffiti, especially by tags and by ugly graffiti, so not this kind of street art. Because what I like is the empowerment of people to go out in the street and leave their own traces and make their own advertisement, and that they don't give nothing on any rules or any laws. And I think this is, in general, like I already said, I don't like things which are fixed and which are clean and predictable, but I like things which are like not under control, which can develop in every direction and which are like open and unpredictable. And I think the graffiti is a really good example for the vandalistic side of graffiti, that something exists which is a big irritation for the system, because it cannot be interpreted and it cannot be categorized. But what I don't like is the development which I see in the moment in graffiti, which goes more and more in the direction of street art, and like finally it's nothing but a design of public space which want to make the public space nicer and more tidy. And this is exactly what I don't like. So I like there's a world here in New York in the 70s and 80s, so the ugly side of that. Yeah, this with black markets, I don't have any special, but I like markets in general, because it's the same, especially flea markets or informal markets, because of the same thing of the empowerment of people, and it creates a chaotic structure and something which is not under control, and people start to make their own business. And
Now, I know, Jan, that you also managed to watch US science fiction films in the 80s and in black market copies, and we were talking yesterday about Alien,
yeah.
You know, Ridley Scott's first Alien. And one thing I would, and I know something in the 80s when video machines were invented, there was actually, like in Lithuania, I guess in Estonia, you used to be able to rent a video player and take it home
mm-hmm.
on a Friday or Saturday night, but there was no state agency for actually the videotapes, which are assumed to be black market, which is very, very funny. It's a curious thing. But one thing when I was thinking about science fiction, and Alien's a great case, is that like American or Western science fiction tends to be very dystopian,
mm-hmm.
like the world is going to end. I mean, often it's saved at the very end, but in former Soviet or Eastern science fiction, it's very utopian.
Yeah.
So there seems to be an implicit criticism of the competing systems from within their own culture. Could you comment? Do you have an idea about that?
I think in both of the types of sci-fi sideways, where the superheroes in somehow never existing. I think U.S. were also using the sci-fi genre.
Louder.
So for some kind of propaganda. I remember the newer movies like Independence Day or Armageddon or The Core that like that work with the same theme, like saving world from somehow from the destroying, and by superheroes, American superheroes, obviously. In communist sci-fi movies or novels, there was not this type of like destroying, but the superheroes basically existed there also, I think, in different type of, I don't know. In Stanislav Lem's, there were like brave cosmonauts, for example, so on.
And with the eventuation of capitalism in the territories that we're talking about, I mean, artists have actually lost their official status because despite Western romanticism about non-conformism in art in Eastern Europe, you have to remember that artists were often at the very top of the social structure, known as nomenklatura, and they've lost the status in the new capitalist society. And do you see yourself as somehow, or artists that you fraternize with as outsiders in this?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if it was like abroad, all around the former Eastern Europe, but in Czech, it was definitely, I think. Yeah.
And Diana, I mean, in terms of risk, if there's a social risk there, I know that the spatial experience you seek of the city is that of estrangement or the status of the l'étranger, and maybe even possible endangerment by going into the parts of town people with cameras don't necessarily go. Could you say something about that?
Yeah, I think German is perfect people to be an outsider. I thought already that I usually take over the perspective of the flaneur and why it's necessary for the flaneur to be not involved in things which he wants to investigate. And this kind of risk or danger, I think what I'm looking for in the city is what the city since ever was standing for is the confrontation with the other or the stranger or like a form of authority. And for this is why I'm more attracted by this outskirts, because in the inner cities you hardly find this confrontation with the with authority nowadays, because everything is so clean and so everything what could be potentially dangerous or like frightening is closed out of the inner city. So this is why I prefer to go in the outskirts. And I think this confrontation with authority could always be dangerous, because it could force you to change your opinion or whatever. So prejudices and cliches. And cliches so become of my own person become visible, and then so maybe I have to change my mind. So I see this dangerous of the or danger of this kind of confrontation more in this direction, that so to go through these areas can change my perspective. So, and so in a way that I don't have any idea in which direction. So maybe this is always something what can be dangerous.
And the caffeine and nicotine addicted amongst you. There's some rustling. I mean, I'm on to my last question. Open up for conversation. I just want to ask both of our artists what they're hoping to discover or produce here in New York if after a week you have any ideas, because they've both been here a short time.
Well, what about that? Trying not to get lost in the underground, I must say. So, yeah. I didn't come with some like exact plan what to do here, because I knew it's just, I'm going to stay here just for 2 months, which is a really short, super short time, I think, for starting kind of new project. So I would like to probably continue my recent work, kind of survey work from Prague, which is based on cryptography, some type of cryptography I've already mentioned, and the output should be probably some kind of small drawings. It's like, yeah, simple.
Yeah.
Yeah, I normally have to be a while in the city to find out what really interests me, but in the last months I came up with the topic of downtown and skyline, and I think this is what I want to investigate a little bit more in New York. So especially, as I said before, that for me the city is the display of all kind of dreams and hopes. So then downtown is the place in the city which is especially connected to with this projection. And we talked yesterday about this, so because I'm really attracted in the moment by the song of Petula Clark, Downtown, and the lyrics express exactly what I'm interested in downtown. And we yesterday talked about there's an episode of Seinfeld which they try to understand what the song is about, and so this will be my plan for the next song.
So at this point, and in recognition that there are other people from the parts of the world we're talking about in the audience, maybe it's time for some productive conversation. I would ask you just to stand up if you ask a question, so we can everybody see who's speaking. Please.
I'm really interested in this idea of the black market, because it's black markets are where people operate with an idea of being other, and there's this kind of authority and other structure, but in the black market everybody kind of knows what's going on. And that's the way for many years artists operated. But today we have this whole big art market that everybody's trying to get into. Do you see a relationship with being an artist and being part of the underground, and how do you reconcile that with the fact that the whole world now of money is supposedly interested in art? And when I say black market, I'm not, I don't mean it's market, I mean it's the idea of being other, with a bigger culture on top of it. I don't know if that's clear. Because the word market is confusing.
Actually, I would say that I mean, I, on the one hand, I can't claim any alterity because I work in the major institution in the country that I live in, and which is maybe the most important institution in a much larger area. So I represent officialdom in one sense. On the other hand, the value structure of society is set up in such a way that contemporary art is entirely outside of official life, or even a regular middle class life that we might understand hasn't developed yet, which includes the contemporary. Maybe this is about to come when the new National Museum opens next year, because there'll be a sort of social pride in that, and we have from Estonia, who will have seen that take place with the opening of the new National Museum called Kumu in February of 2006. So at this time, we are actually trading a set of things which is kind of only attractive to teenagers, people in their 20s, and people involved with art. It's just like Hans Harker's survey works in the 70s, which prove that most people that go to art galleries are actually somehow involved in them. And at this time, the first dealer gallery in Lithuania opened 1 month ago. And they actually know that they can't sell stuff at the moment. So the first show was a curated show of conceptual art curated by Adam Carr, English curator, and it was all things for $10, you know, texts and albums and stuff, because they understand first they have to put cool ideas into the bloodstream before they ever, you know, get to putting paintings on the walls and selling them. So, yeah. But there are two other people. Do you have anything to say?
Connection between
black
market and art market. Yeah, from the Czech like position of outsider, let's say, it has something to do with black market and art market, and you have the same divided person into outsiders and insiders, definitely. But I don't know. The rules are completely the same. I don't think so.
I couldn't hear what you just said. The last part of what you said, I couldn't hear.
You said like the black market, the art market is divided between insiders and outsiders, but he doesn't know if there's a clear relationship in what happens in Czech.
Yes.
Next.
You? You go first and then
sorry. Somebody stand up.
I was just wondering what you think the role of alternative or not-for-profit spaces plays in this sort of market. And I suppose that fits in with what you're saying about the other or the black market or the alternative space that
Do you have any not-for-profits or volunteer spaces?
We have, yeah.
So you do.
I think I didn't understand all of the questions.
What role do artist-run spaces play within the city economy? So
I think in Czech they substitute the institutions because, for example, like main institution, National Gallery in Prague, which is the director of which Milan Kunčák was ex-member of Fluxus, quite famous person from the 60s, is somehow completely wrong, I think. Last year they made a prize, for example, which was called 333, according to money that winner gets from the sponsor, from the main sponsor, who is like main Czech energy supplier, who has very, very bad reputation all around the Czech Republic. Even the program is somehow quite suspicious. So non-profit spaces in Czech really substitute like big institutions in their program, which is sometimes quite ambitious.
I can say in Vilnius there are no artist-run or not-for-profit spaces. There's now Rail Artels, space. But it's incredibly frustrating because I'm constantly criticized both personally and institutionally as one of the people responsible for monopolizing the space of art. But at this time, because it's sort of a Soviet hangover, and I like to call it a long hangover because it's 16 years now, there was no such thing as part-time work, and there was no such thing as productivity for yourself and a number of ideas like that. So there's no and even now the wages are so low for all sorts of things that students and young people just prefer not to do them. So as Carmen was saying, there's no artist-run space in Tallinn. There's a new one, and it's not in Riga either, and certainly not in Minsk, and it's not in, you know, so it's actually a huge frustration that these things aren't evolving, because there's all sorts of empty architecture that they could get their hands on, but there's no gearing towards, and maybe it's because there's no sense in which you can actually develop a career as an artist. In any case, because many not-for-profits in this day and age are about your first career block outside of art school, you know. So if there's no career trajectory, there's no reason to do a kickstarting maneuver. It's a weird space, which I find very frustrating.
I have a question for Diane, Jana. Mm-hmm. I would like to know how you see personally a difference between viewing advertisement and the possibility to remove yourself from the actual intention of the advertisement. And for example, seeing Lenin or flags or similar sorts of those things in a regime. How's that different?
You mean the difference between an advertisement and a flag, or if there's a difference?
No, the difference you experience now, let's say, in capitalism, to see a lot of advertisement mm-hmm. as opposed to in that format.
Okay.
GDR seeing political propaganda yeah. in the same manner. What is the difference? Mm-hmm.
I think this is what I'm so attracted to advertisement. There was no advertisement in GDR apart from this political ones, but not that much. As you, when you now see pictures from China, you have the flags and this huge images everywhere. So this was not like that in the GDR. It was more when we had special days, like 1st of May, we had to make our demonstration with the images, but. The normal street in a GDR city was green, and for this is maybe I'm especially attracted to images in the city, and I see an advertisement in the first sight as an image. So, and I think so I don't give something about what this image wants to tell me. I see it like how it is put in a situation and into a context. And I try always to make my pictures like that it could be maybe read in a different way, or that it could be maybe open to a different kind of interpretation. So I don't know if you understood. But what really irritates me about the United States is that there are a lot of flags everywhere, because I think this is especially not because I'm from Eastern part of Germany, if not because I'm German in general, because in Germany we have this little problem with our flags to show national signs, and for me it's really strange, so I'm not used to see so many flags.
Well, when you talked about comics and superheroes, there's this other movie genre, the spy movies that puts like James Bond, like the superhero, and the alien or the destructive part of the movie is the Soviet stuff. So what do you think about that? Well, I assume nothing good. But can you tell us about it?
I don't know. I tried to divide this genre into like two halves, like Eastern and Western, let's say, basically. I think in some movies with Jim Bond there were some like Russian, British, or fight, but I think the genre was split into two halves. I don't remember, like, or my memories are not so focused on this problem within just one specific comic book or movie, whatever.
For people that do have opportunity to travel and are fascinated on the Cold War, actually the largest ever exhibition tackling this topic called Cold War Modern Art, Architecture and Design will be opening at the Victoria and Albert Museum on the 19th of September this year, which has been almost a decade-long research project by Jane Pavitt and David Crowley. David Crowley is a great historian of Soviet modern art, or communist modern architecture. I know about trying to get a venue here in New York City, and that's gathered James Bond films, Kubrick films, furniture, automotive design, art from all over the world. Actually, it's going to be one of the great I think exhibitions of this decade. Maybe I'm really looking forward to it. So I've had no involvement with it. I'm just saying this is going to be something super to see. I think.
Yeah, I have more of a comment than a question, but when you talked about the Eastern European identities in the beginning, and more of in the search of that common denominator, then I could really relate to the two things that Diane brought up, the two parallel realities, the one you experienced daily and the one you had at home when you went home in Munich. And then also the total distrust in authorities and then bigger structures, because at the time the big changes happened, originally from Estonia, and I was at the time 13. So I don't think it gets any more extreme when your history teacher teaches you one version, the Soviet version, one day, and then 2 months later she changes her story. I think it's just it just concludes in utter distrust in all the systems and authorities. And I can still observe these kind of attitudes in myself right now. So. And another thing that I want to say, the perfect period piece for me from 1989 that actually connects Estonia and Prague in a very interesting way is a public intervention by Jan Tomik, who is currently one of the most internationally known Estonian artists. At the time, he was just a student and on a school trip to Prague, and he went to the main bridge, I can't remember the name of the bridge, in Prague, and he stood there with the sign. It was written in Estonian, so nobody could understand it, but if you translated it to English, it meant, my dick is clean. He stood there all day, and it's just, I think the whole social chaos and political chaos and everything that was changing that time, I think it just really comes down for me to this one piece on the Prague Bridge in 89.
I mean, one shared experience still is social, so that I have to remember, even though great parts of Eastern Europe are now members of the EU, there's only one which recently converted to the Euro, which was Slovenia, the very first. And we have these funny krona.
Yeah.
We have these funny currencies that are worth very small amounts of money. So that when artists and art professionals travel, we all end up hanging out together because we go to the cheapest restaurants and the cheapest bars together, and there's a real bonhomie, as Karen, you must know. You know,
I think that's interesting, because I think the euro system has grown at the same rate as it was in the beginning when we switched from the Russian money system.
Yeah, it's.
But you're correct about the euro.
Yeah. 3.452. So we're anybody else have an observation or a question?
I have a
this is a comment as well, maybe more than a question. We talked a lot about, you talked a lot about the differences between America and Eastern Europe. And I can't help thinking that in some ways, some of the things you're saying, you're actually quite similar to certain parts of the American mentality. In the way that you're talking about the flaneur, it's not that far from the way we talk about the cowboy. The idea of the lone observer who's kind of an object that rolls into town is not directly related somehow. The distrust in certain authorities, the urge to be disassociated. I can't help thinking, I grew up in Denmark, so I was quite close to all of you, and I was on another planet, obviously, in a way, because I grew up with a trust in authority to this day. I don't have the kind of distrust, and it's not, I mean, you can be critical, obviously, but I don't have that skepticism that you're talking about, obviously. So in some sense, I can't help thinking, even though you're from two ends of the spectrum somehow, you do share a certain,
last night I went to see Sam Shepard's new play, Kicking a Dead Horse, and it's a one-man play, and the actor is Stephen Rea, the Irish actor, and I couldn't help but think that the reason that Shepard had cast an Irishman and a Scotsman would also be appropriate is because I think these people still romantically identify with the man alone and the outsider and the West and the frontier and the romantic parts of America that one would see fading within the body politic. I was really asking myself, why, when you have a cowboy stuck in the desert with a dead horse, would you cast an Irishman instead of a sort of raw-boned American actor like Shepard himself, and that was what I could come up with. I mean, people can certainly disagree on that point because the culture is not mine. But,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I think as we're reaching, 8 o'clock, we should wrap up. So, first of all, a round of applause for and thank you to Apex Art, and thanks to you all for being such an attentive audience.
Institutions, but I think we touched on it a little bit in terms of other spaces and things like that.